everyone, and welcome to episode 96 of season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is David Brook of Blueprint Review. Welcome back to the show, David.
Hello, thanks for having me. It's going to be fun. One of my favorite films. Excellent.
I'm very glad to hear that. It's always nice to talk about Die Hard, you know, even with people who were on previous shows with Playtrains and Automobiles, for instance. You know, so it's hopefully going to be a very, very fun week. We have a lot to talk about. There's a lot of stuff going on, and we'll just have to we'll have to maybe ask you a few questions just to see if you got anything in the chamber. Who knows? Left the wings. So episode 96 begins with John showing that he knows the truth and ends with John ducking under a table for cover. So basically the way that we ended things last week was that, you know, John was with Clay, William Clay, Bill Clay. And, you know, he decided to give Bill Clay a gun. And the two of them are on their way. And then we find out that Bill Clay, or John finds out that Bill Clay is not really Bill Clay. We already know it's not. we know who it is. It's Hans Gruber. And Hans, you know, points the gun at John and tells him that he wants his detonators. And John turns around and goes, "Well, well, well, Hans." You know, and the way that he responds there, he's basically showing both us and Hans that he knew that this is what was going to happen. You know, he was able to predict that something was fishy about Bill Clay. You know, do you get that sense also, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's more obvious, I guess, at the end, but because he doesn't have, well, unless we get to that later, but.
Right.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But just trying to get that. From his
I don't think you get that idea. You don't get that idea straight away. I think early on, going back to, I guess, the previous episode, you kind of feel like he doesn't realize, because there's that moment where doesn't he look at he sees the names on the
yes, he sees the names on the yeah. on, about the floor plan and stuff like that. And we went through last week all the names. Most of the more than half of those names are people in the production. We were able to go through and find a whole bunch of them.
Excellent.
That are so, part of the production.
Because I guess you could see that. I don't want to step on the toes of the previous episode, but I guess you could see that shot of him clocking the sign as. Either way, I think when I rewatched the film recently, in my head, I got the idea that, oh no, he thinks because he's on that list, he must be an employee. So in my mind there, he doesn't know that he's a bad guy. He's testing him, and Hans has passed the test at that moment in my mind. So to be honest, rewatching it, I mean, I haven't seen it before, so I know what happens, but I couldn't remember every detail. So in my head, I was thinking, oh, no, he mustn't realize. And how is he going to get out of this one? But I think by this minute, how he reacts when Hans turns around with the gun does suggest that he knew. So, yeah, he's not. He doesn't look scared, so to speak.
Correct. He had a very high suspicion.
Yeah.
I guess you can say it that way.
But the kind of cinematic language, if you like, before of showing the sign and stuff made you suggest that he didn't know. Or was
Correct.
Testing him and
yeah. Right. Well, obviously his question was when he introduced himself was to test him to see how, you know, Hans would react. And one of the things we talked about last week was, you know, Hans had a 1 in 50 shot of actually using a name that John didn't know, you know, because he doesn't know how many people John really knows there. You know, it just so happens that maybe he knows who Bill Clay is. You know, we don't know.
Yeah, or he's seeing that same sign or whatever.
Exactly. You know, we brought up a theory last week that Bill Clay is the inside man that Hans killed beforehand, so he knew that Bill Clay wasn't going to be showing up. So that's possible. You never know.
Yeah, maybe.
Because the movie seems to go in the direction that there's possibly an inside man that would give away some of this information that, you know, that they would know how much money there is and stuff like that. But It's never really discussed. So,
they know an awful lot about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we brought up the theory that maybe there was an inside man. And then we were thinking about it and we said, wait a second, maybe the inside man was Bill Clay. And that would work out perfectly because then Hans knows that Bill's not at the, not at the party because he's like in someone's trunk or something like that. Maybe he's outside in Theo's trunk, that type of thing. Yeah. And Hans then says to him, put it down now. And I love, one of the things I love about this scene is that both of them think they have the upper hand.
Yeah.
Hans believes that he has the upper hand because he's holding a gun. And John, we will find out a little later in this minute why he thinks he has the upper hand. But he's also acting very cocky the entire time. Mm. And then John continues talking to him. He's sort of trying to bait Hans. You see him lick his lips, stuff like that. And he goes, that's pretty tricky with that accent. You want to be on TV with that accent.
Yeah.
But what do you want with the detonators, Hans? I already used up all the explosives, or did I? Now, do you think this conversation is for us more, or is it for John to be telling Hans that he was able to see through the whole thing, and now he's working the whole story out verbally? What do you think?
I think it's probably a bit of both. I do get the idea that that John's trying to find out why he needs these detonators. He does seem pretty confused and kind of curious about that. But it's for the audience as well. I mean, I guess everything is in the film.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
Yeah, yeah. It is also to help spell things out a bit and try and.
And it does. They do a nice job of that.
Oh yeah.
For sure. And as John is talking, he's walking casually towards Hans, which is great because he's also able to shorten the distance between the two of them. Yeah. Because, he's not concerned that Hans is going to try and shoot him.
No.
And then Hans says, I'm going to count to three. And and then he goes, yeah, like you did with Takagi. So but the part of my problem with that phrase is it makes it sound as if he didn't count to three with Takagi. It makes it sound as if, oh, you're going to count to three. You're going to say you're going to count to three like you said you were going to count to three with Takagi. But we know that he did count to three with Takagi. He actually gave Takagi even more than 3 seconds, with the way that he did that.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. Yeah. It's true.
So I was thinking about the fact that he's saying he's going to count to three. What do you think the origin of the idea of counting? So counting down to something, counting up to three, that type of thing.
Oh, I don't know. It kind of feels like a Western kind of thing, but whether it's from the movies or some kind of historical record, I don't know. It's certainly seems like a cowboy kind of showdowny kind of thing, maybe. I don't know. Oh, right. Well, oh, no, it could be a duel, like in the kind of ye olde days in Europe as well, maybe.
Where you mean like 10 paces and stuff like that?
Yeah, 10 paces kind of thing, maybe.
Right, but this comes across as more of a threat. This is the type of thing is you and I, we're both parents. So, it's the type of thing you say to your kid, all right, I'm going to count to three.
Yeah.
Or you're not going to get dinner or whatever the punishment, I guess these days, no cell phone for an hour or whatever it is. Yeah. But, it sounds more like a threat. So, I decided to try and look it up. And what I found was some pretty interesting things. First of all, that I found a reference from 1848.
Wow.
Okay, in a book called The Doctrine of Education by Jean Paul, where it says another parental delay, that of punishment, is of use for children of the second 5 years. Parents and teachers would more frequently punish according to the line of exact justice if, after every fault in a child, they would only count four. And 20, or their buttons, or their fingers. They would thereby let the deceiving present round themselves, as well as round the children escape. The cold, still empire of clearness would remain behind. So, again, there is a reference here to the idea that you're supposed to count off to a child. And that's Now, the other reference that I found is from 1853, which is closer to what you mentioned. Okay, this was in a magazine called The Friend Magazine, that was published in January 1853. And it says, do you hear me, sir? Asked the captain. I give you whilst I count 10 to start. I do not wish to shoot you, Wilson, but if you do not move before I count 10, I'll drive this ball through you. As I hope to reach port, I will, raising his pistol until it covered the boatswain's breast. The captain commenced counting in a clear and audible tone. Intense excitement was depicted on the faces of the men, and some anxiety was shown by the quick glances cast by the chief mate and steward, first at them and then at the crew. Wilson, with his eyes fixed in the captain's face and his arms loosely folded across his breast, stood perfectly quiet, as if he were an indifferent spectator. 8, 9, said the captain. There is but one left, Wilson. With it, I fire if you do not start. So again, it fits into both references that we mentioned. So it works. It sounds more like a punishment the way that Hans is saying it, you know, because I mean, obviously, as we know with Takagi, that was a punishment. Yeah, you know? He didn't say I'm going to count to 10 and then I'm going to shoot you. He said I'm going to count to 3. You know why he chose? I wonder if it's more prevalent nowadays within the last 20-30 years to say you're going to count to a smaller number than to a higher number. You don't really hear people say, "Okay, I'm going to count to 6." You know,
I guess it's
it's either 3 or 10. I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I guess in the film, it's probably more likely to be 3 because it takes too long to count to 10.
That's true.
Well, if you really want to draw the tension out, maybe, but.
Right.
If you're an action movie, it's maybe up a bit.
Okay, that's true. That's very true. And at this point,
I guess it also sounds, in a way, it's more evil because you're giving them less time. You're like, right, you've got a very small amount of time before I kill you. Maybe it's more threatening.
Okay, that's true also. And at this point, after John continues to bait him, so Hans pulls the trigger and nothing happens. Did you count how many times he pulled the trigger?
No, I can't remember.
So he pulled the trigger 5 times. Okay, which doesn't make sense because it's an automatic pistol. You know if it was a revolver or something like that, it would make more sense. And because also, if you have an automatic, have you ever shot an automatic pistol?
No.
Okay, so there's a cartridge. So there's a bullet in the top of the cartridge. So if you pull the trigger and it doesn't go, it's either jammed or there's no bullet in there. And if it's jammed, if by continuing to pull the trigger, that's not going to help. If you have a revolver, so each time you pull the trigger, the cylinder, changes.
Yeah, spins around. Yeah.
It spins around. So therefore, there's more of a chance. And that goes. And that reminded me of the idea of Russian roulette.
Mm.
Are you familiar with Russian roulette?
Yes. Yeah. Deer Hunter, everyone knows her.
That's true. That's very true. So what you want to explain what Russian roulette is then?
Oh, well, when it's you put like one bullet in the chamber of a six shooter, whatever you call it, you spin it round, you don't know where it's going to land, you close it, and then you give it to someone, they have to shoot themselves in their head, they have to pull the trigger aimed at their head, and they've obviously got 1 in 6 chance of blowing their brains out.
Correct.
Yeah, and you pass it round, I guess,
right,
between 2 people
or however many there are, sometimes you can play. So right, Russian roulette is a potentially lethal game of chance in which a player places a single round in a revolver, spins the cylinder, places the muzzle against the head or body of the opponent or of themselves, and pulls the trigger. If the loaded chamber aligns with the barrel, the weapon will fire, killing or severely injuring the player. Okay. The fact that it's called Russian roulette refers to the supposed country of origin and roulette to the element of risk-taking and the spinning of the revolver cylinder, similar to a roulette wheel. That's the whole thing. You don't know where it's just... So the first trace of the idea of Russian roulette came in a short story called The Fatalist, which was written in 1840. And it was written by Mikhail Lermontov, who was a Russian poet and writer. So with the story, which takes place in a Cossack village, so he decides that he wants to, he wants to propose a bet. And in order to prove it, what he does is he takes a pistol, one of the pistols that they have there, and then he cocks it and accepts the challenge to randomly take the pistol and not knowing whether it was loaded or not. And then he says, I will pay 20 gold pieces for me, putting the muzzle of the pistol to his forehead. He then asks to throw a card in the air, and when the card touches the ground, he'll pull the trigger. The weapon fails to fire, but when he cocks the pistol again and aims it at a service cap hanging over the window, a shot rings out and smoke fills the room. The term of Russian roulette, I mean, this was when the first idea of the game was written somewhere or whatever, but the term calling it Russian roulette was probably first used in a short story that was called the same, that was also called the same thing. It was called A Hero of Our Time by George Sirdis in 1937. So I find it very interesting. I mean, I went in, I found information about like the probability and all that stuff of you know, like what are the chances that if you have a bullet in the chamber that you're going to blow your head off, you know? So obviously it's a 1 in 6 chance, which is 16.7%. But they say that the odds are very different because of that. Because again, it goes into all these different, you know, mathematical equations and stuff like that, which I can honestly say I don't really understand. So I'm not going to try and explain. I mean, there's a lot of you'd think that someone wouldn't do the math on something like this, but apparently they did, and it's you know, they say that you know, the odds are not 1 in 6. It's actually very different. So I don't know. What can I tell you? So there are some notable incidents that we know about it, that we've heard, in history that we can find about Russian roulette. So there was a case in 1946 it was a Pennsylvania Supreme Court where this teenager was being convicted of murder in the second degree because he was shooting a friend, he shot a friend. Right, they were playing a modified version of Russian roulette called Russian poker, in which they took turns aiming and pulling the trigger of the revolver at each other rather than at their own heads. The court ruled that when an individual commits an act of gross recklessness without regard to the probability that death to another is likely to result, that individual exhibits the state of mind required to uphold a conviction of manslaughter, even if the individual did not intend for death to ensue. So basically, these two kids were playing and, you know, they were shooting at each other and one of them killed the other.
Jesus.
Yeah, seriously. In the autobiography of Malcolm X, so Malcolm X actually talks about an incident during when he was a burglar where he played Russian roulette and he pulled the trigger 3 times in a row to convince his partners in crime that he wasn't afraid to die. So apparently at the end of the book, so Alex Haley wrote in there that apparently Malcolm X revealed to him that he palmed the round, meaning that there was no bullet in there, you know, in order to do that. And in the 1992 film adaptation of Malcolm X, they actually have that in there. There's a scene about that. I don't recall that scene. I guess I should probably rewatch that movie in order to, you know, figure about that. So there was a American blues musician named Johnny Ace, who in 1954 killed himself after he accidentally shot himself by playing Russian roulette. Who else? Graham Greene, in one of his stories, The Sword of Life, which was an autobiography, was his first autobiography. He said that he played it quite often as a teenager by himself. Where else? Let's see. Apparently, John Hinckley Jr., who attempted to assassinate Reagan in 81, he was known to play Russian roulette on numerous times. And he even had, there's a famous picture of him from 1980 where he pointed a gun at his head. Then there's the one that you mentioned, the movie The Deer Hunter, you know, with Christopher Walken and Robert De Niro, where, you know, at that point they even, you know, go to greater lengths by putting more than one bullet in the chamber also when they do that. You probably don't remember who this was. Do you know who the actor John Eric Hexham was?
No.
Okay, so he was an actor in the early 80s who was on a TV show called Voyagers, which was one of my favorite shows as a kid. It was a time travel show where these two people had to go in and try and fix real events. Not like Quantum Leap where they were fixing, just different people. They went to like ancient Egypt, and apparently there was a problem, and the basket of Moses wasn't put in the Nile, so they had to place the basket in the Nile. Like fix little things and stuff like that. And then after that, he was on another show called Cover Up, where he played like a bodyguard for like a fashion consultant or something like that. And during one of the days of shooting, so he was playing Russian roulette with a revolver that had a blank in it, and he actually killed himself because the gun was too close to his head, and he ended up fracturing his skull, and bone fragments went through his brain.
Jeez.
And that happened on October 12th, 1984. I remember when that happened because it was a really big thing at the time. Those are pretty much the big ones that I found. There's a whole bunch of there's an MMA fighter, Ivan JP Cole, who killed himself playing Russian roulette in 2016. That's a lot of information about Russian roulette, but it fits in really well here. What can I tell you? And so after Hans starts shooting the gun five times and nothing happens, just by hearing the click and stuff like that. So John, shows at this point how clever he was by the fact that he gave him an empty gun. Makes you wonder that if Bill Clay was really a hostage who escaped, what would have happened? He would have been in some place and he would be shooting at Carl, and Carl would have shot him in a few seconds because he didn't have a gun with bullets in it. So I guess it shows that John really was suspicious of the fact that he had a high suspicion that this was not really a hostage. For whatever reason. And then he says to Hans, he goes, "Oops, no bullets. You think I'm f-ing stupid, Hans?" And then we hear like the ding of the elevator. And he, first of all, it's perfect timing for that elevator ding to go off. And at this point, Hans then says to him, "You were saying?" And the rest of the minute, which is almost, it's a good 20, 25 seconds, it's all just action. So at this point, we see Carl, Franco, and Fritz come out of the elevator. And then John looks at them and starts to run and scream as he's doing it. I don't know why he's screaming as he's, running. And he opens fire into the elevator bank. And, Carl manages to get over to the other side, but Fritz doesn't. And he basically, cuts Fritz in half with his shots, and then Franco takes cover on the other side, and like he takes his gun and starts shooting it, but that's like a really, really awkward angle. Do you see how he's shooting? I don't know how that's possible. That just doesn't seem plausible that someone could try and shoot that way.
Because it's like he's trying to hook it around a corner or something. It's just bizarre.
Exactly. And I mean, maybe if he's a lefty, it's possible. I don't know. It looks very strange the way that he's doing it. Anyone who's interested in seeing what we're talking about, where you can go to second 48 and you'll be able to see exactly how he's holding that gun, and that's just really, really strange. And then Carl begins to shoot back and ends up shattering three panels of glass as John continues to run away. And then Carl shoots again, and we see three glass panels shatter. But if you notice, they're the same exact panels that he just shot beforehand. They give it to us from a different angle to make it seem as if they're different ones. But Carl hasn't changed his position at all. He's shooting from the same place, so he wouldn't really be able to shoot another three panels. Like
I guess
further
it's something
down.
they do occasionally in action films. They'll shoot it from they'll often use multiple cameras for set pieces, and They'll quite, although that's an unusual one, because they quite often do it for explosions where they'll cut to a different angle and show it again. But it's usually directly afterwards. Here, you do cut away to John running, and then you cut back to the window almost as though it's pretending it's another set of windows when
exactly.
It isn't. So yeah, it is an odd one. It's a slightly different to. Sorry, no, it doesn't cut back to John. It cuts to the guy shooting.
Cuts to Carl. Right. Now, I mean, earlier in this movie, we caught some other scenes where they showed like the when they shoot the rocket. You know, Alexander and James are shooting the rocket. So the second time they shoot it, it's just another shot of the first one. You know, they don't really shoot it a second time. You know, they use this. They just use a different angle of that same shot. So I guess they tried. You know, they tried fooling us. They didn't think that someone 34 years from now would be doing. 34 years from then would be doing. Would be looking at the movie so closely that we would be able to catch these type of things.
Obviously, cutting corners, cutting costs.
Exactly. And then John continues to run, and at this point, both Carl and Franco can start chasing him. And John then jumps under a cubicle or over a cubicle. And then we see that Carl basically kills a computer screen that starts, you know, we see all these sparks flying out of the computer screen. And Carl just continues to shoot. And then John ends up ducking under a table. And that's pretty much how this minute ends. So is there anything else you wanted to talk about before we get into the script?
I guess what I found, what I noticed watching these this second again, I'll need to watch the other seconds again to see if it happens again, but almost this entire minute, is shot at a slightly Dutch or cant or Dutch angle, however you want to call it, where it's a slightly off kilter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's I'm wondering if that's a style thing or if it's because, I guess, in that moment, you've got... you've got a bit of a flip-flop of situation, so you kind of the scene starts and you think Hans has got the upper hand, then you start to realize John's got the upper hand, and then obviously it spins around again. Is it all about disorientating the audience and just kind of putting us off kilter, so to speak?
Is that what a Dutch angle is meant to do?
It looks kind of cool.
Is that what a Dutch...
Well, it's used for different I think it can be used that for that occasionally. Like you'll see it it kind of got used in film noir quite a bit back in the day, and sometimes it'd be when the situation's a bit messed up, it puts the, because it's putting the audience at a slant, so it's making you feel uncomfortable and not necessarily confused, but it puts you off balance. It's like being off balance because everything's at a tilt. So I do think it can be used as that for that. Sometimes, like with any kind of camera techniques, it's just used because it looks interesting, which may well be the case, but I think it's worth toying with the idea that it was done on purpose at this moment of kind of treachery and confusion and things like that. I don't know. What do you reckon?
Well, first of all, I'm not a computer. I'm not a camera person. So I didn't even notice till you mentioned the fact that it was on an angle. You know,
if you look almost every shot in that minute.
Yeah, for sure. Once you said it to me, I understood it. I mean, it's funny how it starts off that John has his head tilted. So it's like he's already, you know, he knows that the camera's tilted, so he's tilting towards it. You know, he's got his, like, head leaning off to the right-hand side. So I think that's funny. But I think you're right. It does give us a very unique view of everything that's going on, you know, because it's all slightly tilted on the side.
Yeah, and there are a lot of clear lines in each shot because of the kind of set that they're in. There's loads of bold, clear lines that makes it really clear that you're at an angle as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Correct.
Whereas occasionally, if you were just shooting outside or something like that, you might not notice if the background's out of focus or what have you.
Right. It's because on the walls, really they have like the, you know, they look like all the different rectangles on the wall.
Yeah, they're panels and things. Yeah. And the windows and things.
Yeah, it's true. All right, so the script has some minor discrepancies. Because it's quite descriptive, I'm going to go through some of it. So first of all, it says, you know, McLean just looks at him. Hans, you're Hans. And then Hans responds, it says, nods, indicating McLean's gun again. Put it down now. And then McLean goes, that was tricky with the accent. I bet you do a great Ed Sullivan. And he goes, why do you need the detonators, Hans? I already used the explosives. I'm going to count to three. McLean coldly. Yeah, like you did with Takagi. McLean raises his machine gun, aims at Hans. Hans pulls the trigger. Click. Astonishment. Click, click, click. McLean steps in carefully, reclaims his pistol. McLean, you think I'm a schmuck, Hans? Hans pales as we hear the ding of an approaching elevator. You were saying? McLean whirls in time to see Carl, Franco, and Fritz coming out of it, firing. McLean fires back, killing Fritz. Carl and Franco take cover. McLean ducks into a water cooler alcove, looks back at where Hans was. He's gone. A swinging office door, the only evidence of his passing. McLean curses himself, then retreats into a bank of computers. So I mean, I like the descriptive way that they, you know, I've never looked at an action movie before from a script perspective, you know, but how descriptive they need to be. And they do a great job here of describing, you know, the action of what's going on, even though there's no water cooler alcove here or whatever, but, you know, it still works. You know, like,
yeah, I guess you get the actual moments of action when you're shooting and running around is often quite brief. It depends. I think you'll occasionally get some very detailed writers who'll break it down, but I think quite often it's I can't remember what film, but I'm sure I've seen some special features where they've made some jokey comment where a script will say the two characters fight, but in actual fact they spent like 2 months training, right, 2 weeks shooting, and like and they had this epic action scene and the script's just like they fight. So that does happen. But it sounds from that script excerpt that they have kind of altered a bit. I don't know it might change as it goes on. But it sounds like it sounds almost like it was written as a lower budget film with a smaller scale office and stuff. But
yeah,
because here, instead of just a little water cooler alcove, you've got this giant bank of computers, yeah, and these huge kind of office space. And yeah,
especially back in the 80s when these computers were supercomputers, yeah, things like that.
Oh yeah,
right. Okay, great. So every Monday we have a segment called Die Hard on a Monday, where my guests will give their top five Die Hard doppelganger films. You know, movies that basically were spawned based on the idea of Die Hard. So what have you got for us, David?
Cool. This is tricky because there's quite a few decent kind of Die Hard knockoffs, and also there's it depends how kind of wide your spread is, because you can argue quite a few films that are certainly influenced by it. But I've tried to pick, I've got a mix, I've got a couple of kind of maybe more obvious choices, and I've tried to throw a few kind of wild cards in there, but it's hard to narrow it down to my absolute favorite.
Well, just to give you an idea, so far of all the guests that I've had, I have 46 different movies that appear on this list.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to say, it's you can kind of, there's loads of good stuff you can put in there.
Yeah.
It's given me a good excuse, because I knew I was on the podcast. I've been trying to catch up on a few that I haven't seen. And yeah, there's some good ones that I watched. But in my list, I think a lot of them have remained, well, the top three are certainly ones that are just old favorites. Although I must admit, I didn't rewatch them, so I haven't watched them for a while, some of them. But anyway. My number five, I'm going to go with something rather different, and I'm going to go with Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa. So I don't know if this one will have come to the US. It's quite a, because Alan Partridge is he's a Steve Coogan's kind of most popular character that he's done on TV in the UK. He did several different series and radio shows and all sorts of things as this Alan Partridge character. I don't know if you're aware of him or know Alan Partridge.
Yeah, I am. I've actually seen Alpha Papa.
Okay, good. I don't have to explain too much. But
not to me. But I'm sure there are other people you might have to explain it to.
Probably, yeah. But he's basically like he's kind of a wannabe TV radio presenter who is he's obsessed with fame, and he's a bit of an asshole, to put it bluntly, and he always has a very grand opinion of himself. It's hard to kind of explain it, and a very inflated ego, and in reality he's never really made it. Like, his TV show goes wrong, and he ends up on, in some of his earlier TV show series and things, he ends up on like regional radio and all this kind of stuff. And he's always ultimately a bit of a failure, even if he acts like he isn't. And Alpha Papa is his kind of feature film debut after being largely just on the small screen and radio. And in Alpha Papa, he's doing one of his regional radio programs, and basically one of his fellow anchors or my brain, I can't think of the name, kind of radio hosts. One of his fellow hosts, he's an aging guy, and he gets sacked because there's a new company that comes into the radio station. He gets sacked, and he just snaps and loses it, so takes everyone hostage and takes the whole radio station hostage, demanding kind of his job back and all this kind of thing. And because Alan has a nice rapport with this guy, although he manages to escape the siege, he's sent back in to try and kind of negotiate and everything. But instead, Alan Partridge uses this as an excuse to fuel his career, and it goes on from there. But it works as a Die Hard film because you've got this kind of siege situation, and you've got this one man trying to solve it, even though he isn't really trying to solve it. Obviously, it ends very differently to Die Hard, but it's certainly inspired by Die Hard, and I enjoy it a lot. I'm a huge fan of the TV series, so I think this did a good job. Quite often TV series don't transition to the film well at all, but I think they did a good job here. So yeah, okay. that had to make my list. Okay, and number four, this is one that I did see recently, just trying to add some Die Hard clones to my list, and this is a film called Toy Soldiers.
Oh, I love that. Love that movie.
Yeah, I should look at more details, but it's let me figure out when it
came out
made.
In 1991.
Yes. Yeah. So 1991, and this is about a public or private school, depending when you come.
It's a private
from.
School, private.
But a private school, yeah. Well, in the UK we call them public schools, which makes no sense whatsoever because they're not public schools. But anyway, and it's a special school for it's a school filled with quite the children of quite rich, mainly very rich, kind of wealthy parents. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of kind of troublemakers in the school, and what happens is a load of terrorists seize control of the boarding school and make a load of demands and stuff, and keep all the pupils prisoner until they get what they want from the government. And what happens is a group of the students, headed by
Sean Astin,
Billy Tepper, who's played by Sean Astin, they kind of come up with a plot to stop the terrorists. So it's, so again, it's a bit Die Hard. Unlike Die Hard, I guess there's a group of them rather than just one of them. But it's got a great cast of kind of up and comers at the time. So you've got Sean Astin, you've got Will Wheaton,
DK Carter.
There are some of the
Lewis Gossett Jr.
I was going to say there's some good old. I was trying to
Denholm Elliott
from the young cast, but yeah, and it's it's not a mega famous film. It's kind of it's got its following, but I watched it for the first time recently. I can remember seeing the trailer a lot when it came out and as a kid, and I just never got around to watching it. But watching it now, I think it really stands up surprisingly well. It's a really good film.
I think it was directed by Andrew Davis, if I remember correctly.
Oh, no, Daniel Petrie Jr.
Oh.
According to
Andrew. Oh, okay. So I don't know why I thought
not
I was...
Not a known...
I don't know why I made that. Okay. I thought it was... Maybe he did something else recently, right before that.
Maybe. But I just really enjoyed it. So I thought I'd stick it in the list as a bit of a semi-wild card. But yeah, it's fun. It's fun. So the rest of my list. So number three, I've gone with Con Air. I must admit, I've not seen it for quite a long time.
Don't let Jay hear you. Remember...
No. Well, to be honest, I was going to rewatch it for this podcast, but then I've been kind of hoping that Jay will invite me on his podcast, and he hasn't yet. But I was going to watch it closest to time if I do get invited. Hint, hint. But Con Air, it's just. From what I remember, it's just a lot of fun. It's goofy, it's over the top, and the Die Hard situation here is you've got Nicolas Cage is a convict. He's if I remember correctly, he's getting released at the time, or he's on his way home or whatever. But the kind of transport plane that he's taken in is, which is filled with other convicts who aren't getting released, or at least most of them aren't. The other hostages, the other convicts take over the plane, and Nicolas Cage is trying to stop them and get home, really, because he's supposed to be released, and it goes on from there. And it's just loads of fun. It's got classic lines, the kind of put the bunny in the box kind of thing. I even say that to my kids when they're tidying up their room. It's got great, way ridiculously over the top action scenes. Again, like Toy Story, it's got amazing cast, a really, really good cast for a kind of what could potentially just be a kind of cheesy action movie. And it just rolls along. It's just fun. So that had to make my list. I'm not sure it's quite as diehardy as some of the other ones, but it's still kind of enclosed kind of space, kind of people taking a kind of a siege going on in a small enclosed space. So if it fits the bill. And then, okay, to number two. So number two, I've gone with Speed. This is one that I've not seen for a long time, but when I was young, I wore the videotape out. I used to watch it all the time. And so, yes, you've got Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock, who I just loved when I was back then. Oh, I still wouldn't say no these days. But yeah, it's just a really tightly directed, just a classic action movie, really. It's tense, it's exciting, it's got nice, good, strong characters. It's got a great villain in Dennis Hopper, Keanu Reeves, and Keanu Reeves... I love Keanu Reeves, but he's really, without wanting to bash him because he's one of the nicest guys ever, he's not the best actor in the world, but given the right roles, he can really excel. And I think he works very well in Speed. He is a good action hero. He's got enough charisma, and he's got the kind of looks and that kind of thing. And I just love it. As I say, it's been too long, but it's still there in my memory.
Well, now you have something to put in your queue.
Definitely. Cool. And then that brings me to number one. So my number one, I've gone with, it had to be really, because I'm a big martial arts movie kind of nut. I had to go with The Raid, which it's slightly different, I guess. Maybe you could argue it's not totally diehardy. But in my defense, because it's not necessarily about kind of terrorists or anything like that, taking control of a small space and the good guy being stuck in it, because really the good guys go into the space which is already inhabited by the bad guys. But again, it's got that enclosed thing. You've got what starts off as a team of kind of a SWAT team kind of cops or whatever, trying to make their way to the top of the building and take out the main bad guy, and that eventually gets whittled down to very few kind of good guys. So I think it's diehardy enough to put on the list, and it has to be the top, because I adore this film. It's mainly for the action. It's so well choreographed and so well directed and edited. It's really punchy. It's stylish. It's got an incredible energy to it. You could argue it's a bit computer gamery in terms of like its kind of levels. He's moving up the building like with a different boss each time or whatever. But I don't care. I think it works, and it's insanely, insanely enjoyable, insanely exciting. So it had to make the list, even if it's maybe not as diehardy as some of the ones, but it's close enough for me.
That's great. So you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
If you check out blueprintreview.co.uk, you'll find my reviews and the reviews of my other writers over there. We tend to review home entertainment releases, but not solely. So yeah, check it out.
And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you might be using to listen to this show. And you can find me very simply just by doing a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay, Kimusabi.